Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer and novelist Jean Mackin. Mackin is the author of several historical novels, including The French Woman, The Queen's War, and The Sweet By and By, which is about Maggie Fox, the founder of the American spiritualism movement. Mackin is also author of the delightful Louisa May Alcott mystery trilogy, written under the pen name Anna McLean. Mackin teaches creative writing at Goddard College in Vermont. And welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tish. Good to be here.
Now, was there a particular time in your life when you discovered writing?
No, actually. I don't remember when I started writing. It's been that long. When I was a kid, I wrote fairy tales, had my little blue notebook filled with them. So it's just something that was always there for me. I grew up in a real small town, and without books and daydreams, I don't think I would have survived.
I've had so many other people say that to me about small towns.
And I, you know, bless you for that, you know, but no, it's always been there. I mean, I always thought I am a writer, and someday the books will be there, so.
Wow, that's great to know your path. Now, you've concentrated quite often on historical fiction. Tell us what attracted you to that.
Kind of a blind spot for the contemporary. I don't look around me and see a lot of narratives that I find really interesting. I'm not interested in the kind of suburban psychodramas, and I'm not an urban person, so I can't write that kind of story. And the history for me, I think it kind of stems from, again, my childhood. I came from a family of storytellers, all sorts of legends and stories about my own family that kept carrying us backwards. And I just kind of fell in love with that sense of how history continues to be around us even when we don't see it. I mean, for me, it's not history. It's still there, maybe just not as noticeable as today's headlines.
Oh, so you don't like family melodrama or psychodrama? Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
But you don't find that in history?
Maybe my family had too many. I do like them, but I give them a historical setting. And, you know, I don't know why that is. It's like I prefer vanilla to chocolate. And I have no idea why. It's just sometimes when a preference is that pronounced, I think you kind of just go with it instead of fighting it. And that's what I've done with my historical fiction. Yeah. I just love historical narratives.
Yeah. Oh, well, I do too. But it's interesting that when somebody chooses just to write about that. Now, you wrote an essay called History as Narrative, in which you said, "Call me an idealist, but perhaps fiction can prevent us from making even bigger and more dangerous idiots of ourselves than the species already has."
How
elaborate
that
on that.
Found that.
Well, I loved it. And it sort of explains to me in some ways why you do this.
Yeah. Like I said, it's still there. There's so much we can learn. And, you know, my memory is failing, but one of the Greek philosophers once said that if you don't have 2,000 years of history at your command, you are living hand to mouth.
Really?
And I love that. I think that's gorgeous. I mean, how can you make plans if you don't know what's liable to happen from the plans? And it's there. It's already happened. I guess I should tell you right now, I'm not a linear thinker. I really believe in cycles and that we keep returning to them.
Well, you must be incredibly disappointed by the fact that we keep repeating history because so many people don't know it.
I am. I mean, especially right now with what's going on with the debt talks and the economic crisis. It's very heartbreaking, and I kind of hope we don't end up back in Victorian child labor circumstances myself.
Yeah, I'm afraid we're going to repeat that as well.
We are so close.
We are.
I find it heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Someone like me who knows nothing about economics can look at that situation and guess what's going to happen. And I realize that much more intelligent people know what's going to happen, and therefore what we're talking about is malicious thinking and ill will.
And a lot of intelligent people seem to be holding their cards close to their vest.
Yeah,
and not speaking out. I don't know.
What are they afraid of?
But let's talk about the last historical fiction novel that you wrote called The Sweet By and By. Mm-hmm. I loved it. Maggie Fox, the Fox Sisters, American Spiritualism Movement. Tell us what got you interested.
Well, my grandmother, who had 10 children, and my mother was the last, so that my grandmother was a late Victorian woman and lived in this wonderful Victorian house, and she herself read quite a bit of spiritualism. And I was too young to know some of the stuff going on, but supposedly in that house, things would fly off shelves, mirrors would fall down. When she died in the winter, the house filled with the scent of lilac. So there were these kind of ghost stories in my family that just at that point, you know, I was a practicalist, a realist, but I loved the narrative quality of them. And so I started reading about Maggie Fox, who, as you said, was the founder of all of this, you know, knock, knock, who's there stuff, and got really delighted by her story. I mean, how I feel about Maggie, she was a poor farm girl with an alcoholic father. I mean, we've got a great setup right there.
Yeah.
For a woman with a lot of talent and maybe not all sincere. But what fascinated me was why people continued to believe in her, even when she said it was a fraud.
Yeah. Well, tell us what she did, too. Her and her sisters would
do these sittings. When they were very young, when they were before their teens, in the eve of April 1st, which is a very interesting date, they were all together in this little farmhouse in the middle of a blizzard in upstate New York, and the walls started rapping. And her father jumped out of bed and ran to the door, and there was nobody there. And the rappings continued, and no one was there. And finally, the little girls giggling under the covers in the bed said, "Daddy, it's Splitfoot," which was, of course, a name for the devil. And the mother was a bit of a fanatic, and immediately all of the neighbors came in, and, you know, my daughters are hearing spirits. And that very evening, they devised the spirit alphabet, which is, you know, the one knock for A, two knocks for B, the whole thing, and they knocked out entire histories. The interesting thing that ultimately I found in my research is that the sisters invented or elaborated a story of a peddler who had been murdered and then buried in the cellar, and it was just like local gossip, you know, this peddler disappeared. And they elaborated the story to prove their credentials, as it were, as spiritualists. And for years, everyone kept saying, they just made it up, they just made it up. But in fact, when the house burned down and they dug in the cellar, they did find a skeleton.
Yeah, that was a remarkable bit of history that they uncovered.
Yeah, so there was a body there. And, you know, probably the bottom line is that there was just truth in that small town gossip that was going around, but the little girls were perceptive enough to pick up on it. And it was their intelligence and their powers of observation that really impressed me about the Fox sisters. I mean, they eventually created a lot of tricks, they used other tricks, but they were, in fact, very intelligent, very perceptive.
Yeah. And this took place in the mid-1800s, we might add.
Yes.
You know what amazes me about this? How many little phases in history to me it seems like hysteria can be built up. The Salem witch trials, all these, Horace Greeley, all these famous people, Houdini, believed these little girls and took them under their wings.
Yeah, Horace Greeley's wife was a big fan. You look at the people who were fans of the Fox sisters, and they were people who were grieving. Yeah. Horace Greeley's wife had lost children. Elizabeth Barrett Browning was a big fan, and she had much grief in her life. They were the grieving people. And I went to a seance once with a friend in, is it Freeville, where we have the spiritual
center
still going?
And
just kind of observe how people interacted. And the woman I went with came out and said, you know, if these were wealthy people with a PhD, they'd be seeing a psychotherapist, but this serves that purpose and it works for them. So it's, you know,
Did you think across the board that that's really true?
No, I mean, there's a lot of people out there to make a lot of money off of it, but when there's sincerity and caring, I think it can be helpful. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing I wanted to do when I wrote Maggie Fox, one thing I didn't want to do is ever sneer at the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it's, you know, I tried to put a little humor into it, but it's not a laughable situation.
Yeah.
Because ultimately it is about grieving.
No, it's a wonderful book. And
Thank you.
And it has a lot of Jean Mackin history in it. Did the research that you did on this book change your idea about spiritualism and ghosts and so on?
The research on Maggie Fox didn't really change my original feelings. But what happened is that whenever I told people I was working on this book, and this is Ithaca, this is a very intellectual, well-educated community. Every time I told people I was working on Maggie Fox, you know, a kind of ghost story, people would say, inevitably, I don't believe in ghosts, and then tell me their own true ghost story. And I became amazed by that. People I never would have suspected as being the least bit superstitious or spiritual or religious or whatever would have true ghost stories. Mm-hmm. And they were fascinating to me because they really believed them. And I became one of those people who said, I don't really believe in ghosts, but... And then have my own ghost story. So I still don't know quite what that all means.
Yeah, so you're sort of an agnostic about whether they exist.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you ever use the Ouija board and try some of that?
I did once in college, and it was quite terrifying, actually.
Really?
I've heard strange stories about Ouija boards, and mine was pretty strange, too. And I do tend to stay away from the Ouija board. I was at a party a couple of days ago, and we thought, ha, 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 let's do the Ouija board. So we did, and nothing happened. And I think I was terrified of it, you know, and I don't know what it is, but weird things happen with Ouija
boards. Well, I think a lot of people are terrified of it, and which leads me to believe that they believe something.
Yeah.
Now you have a forthcoming essay, or perhaps it's already out, called The Fox Sisters and American Spiritualism. It's going to be an essay in a book, is that so?
Oh, yeah. That was printed, that was published in a magazine called New York Archives a few years ago after I finished the book.
Well, I was wondering, when you write a real essay about this topic as opposed to a historical fiction, do you approach it in a different way?
Yes.
Well, tell us how.
I cut down a little bit on my daydreaming and stick to pretty much what can be verified, what could be researched and authenticated. I'll speculate about motives, because I can't get away from that. That's what historians and fiction writers do. But I'd stick closer to the facts than I do in my own fiction. Although Maggie Fox story, the novel has two timelines. There's a journalist who's researching Maggie Fox, and then there's the story of Maggie Fox herself. And the Maggie Fox story is actually not fictionalized. The dialogue, of course, is, but so much of almost all of the events in Maggie Fox in that novel are true. Her secret marriage to Eliza Kent Kane, the explorer, her terrible time in that girls' boarding school so she could learn how to use a fish fork or whatever, her father's alcohol problem, Maggie's later problem with drink and drugs, and the fact that Mrs. Abraham Lincoln visited her. Those things were all known about Maggie.
No, I figured that part of it was true, which makes it incredibly fascinating, really incredibly fascinating. Before we do run out of time, I want to talk about your Louisa May Alcott mysteries. How did you ever get involved in this?
I was actually in Worcester, Massachusetts at the Antiquarian Society researching a different novel, which I still haven't finished. And the representative of the Louisa May Alcott estate took me out to lunch and said, "We like your historical fiction. Do you think Louisa would be a good detective?" And I said, "What a great idea." So we did it. We did it. I took a couple of drafts to get the book to where we wanted it, because it needed to be a cozy for Louisa, which is to say it's not a real dark kind of mystery. And we all felt very strongly that when I wrote it, I wanted it to be on a slightly lighter, at times almost humorous level.
And it works. I read the first one, of course.
Thank you.
Louisa and the Missing Heiress.
Thanks.
It was fascinating mystery.
Thanks.
But I would think it would be somewhat hard to use a real person as the heroine in it?
Actually, not at all, because I can read her diaries and her letters and her journals, and I don't have to create her character. She's already there. Okay. I don't have to guess what would she do in this situation, because you can do enough research to know what Louisa May Alcott would have done, and you can see in her diaries and her journals what her relationship to her family was. So in a way, it's almost easier to work with a real character.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jean Mackin. She's a novelist and writer, and we're talking about her Louisa May Alcott mystery trilogy, in which she writes as Anna McLean. Now, tell us why you chose to use a pen name for this series.
Simply because it's kind of a tradition when you skip from genre to genre to sometimes adopt a different name and a different persona. And I thought this might be my only chance, so I did it. And you notice I kept very close to the roots, though. You know, you still got the Scottish-Irish thing going on. And Anne is a name that appears in almost every culture, I think. So I didn't stray too far. But it was fun to be able to name myself.
Did it take a long time to figure that one out?
Not really. I think we spent a couple of days on it. And then, that sounds good.
Well, tell me if you really change personas when you're writing as Anna McLean. That seems very interesting. Because to me, the books are incredibly different, your historical fiction and these.
Yeah. Writing mysteries is, for me, a very, very different process than writing historical fiction, because the mysteries are so structured so tightly, and you have to be very aware of where you're dropping clues, how much is revealed, and at what stage, and it doesn't have the same kind of flow as the historical fiction does for me. So it was a very, very different writing process, and my persona didn't change. I mean, I have the same wardrobe and all of that, but the way I wrote it did change. That was a real kind of on-the-job training experience.
Well, you know, I would think somebody who's free to write historical fiction, which is out in the clouds anywhere you want to go, I would think in some ways the mystery genre would be almost claustrophobic because it is a formula in some ways.
The only time I really felt that was when I had to write about the relationship between Louisa and her father, because there were places I couldn't go. Mm. Not that they were awful, but they were a little deeper, a little more psychological than what could fit in this particular type of mystery. But most of the time, that didn't bother me. I mean, I love comedy, too. I mean, I listen to P.G. Woodhouse on tape 4 or 5 times a week just for the laugh. You know,
I think it's interesting, though, that, you know, it seems to me years ago when I was a kid, people who used pen names would never reveal their real selves. And now everybody's eager to in some ways, you know?
Well, I thought about that a lot. And my publisher asked me, okay, what are we going to do? This is a pen name. Do you want your real name to appear anywhere in the book? And we decided that we would put my actual name and biography kind of at the last page on the book, because I thought, I'm really not hiding anything. I'm not, you know, changing my name because I've written something deceitful that I don't want anyone to know about. It really was more about creating a different persona on the page, but not a secret. I mean, I was quite open with everyone about it. So.
But it amazes me how many writers can change almost their style. You know, Joyce Carol Oates as Rosamund Smith and all these. And they actually change their writing style. To me, it's almost like you're channeling some kind of stranger to be able to use these pen names and really change your style.
Well, you wonder about. You wonder about that sometimes. But, you know, the imagination is this huge place. It's just huge. Mm-hmm. So you can go lots of places with it.
Well, I also want to ask you this. Do you use different techniques in regard to research when you're doing a historical novel than the Louisa May Alcott?
Actually, no.
Really?
I would say, the research is the same. I go first to journals and diaries and letters if they exist. Then you hear their voice. Then you hear the actual voice of the person. And then I'll start with secondary sources, going from the very general to the specific, so that I can start building up details. Because, you know, writers, there's kind of 2 ways to write. One is to write big and then reduce, and the other is to write small and then add. And I tend to write small and then add, because I really love getting the details in. So the research for me is largely about details. What did people eat for breakfast? You know, what was the mattress stuffed with? Those things, I think, are so important. I really am a materialist. One of my, you know, affirmations, what are you grateful for? I'm grateful to live in a world of arranged molecules. You know, such a materialist.
Now that is an interesting way of thinking about life.
We could be free-floating out there, you know?
Some of us would rather be.
But it's the details are what the research is about, and that really occurs the same way in both genres.
I want to ask you this, too. Since you're dealing with real people in both the historical and the Louisa May Alcott, do you have to get kind of release forms or permission from living ancestors for accuracy?
No. I'm not quite certain what the law is, but isn't...
You aren't?
No.
Oh, dear.
But isn't it certain that you can't libel the dead or something like that? I don't know.
You mean it's impossible to do so, or you're not allowed to?
I think that it's not a lawsuit case. If a person is dead, they are subjects for fiction. I mean, we've got novels about Abraham Lincoln and even much more recent.
And some histories actually are fictionalized too nowadays.
Oh, tell me about it. Really? I know, for someone who writes historical fiction, I hated to study history in college because the texts were so deadly and so questionable in their emphasis. I can't talk about their accuracy because I'm not that much of a scholar, but boy, history is open.
What do you do about living relatives, though? Have you had any of the living relatives of the Fox sisters, say, or Louisa May Alcott, ask you, what are you doing? You know, why are you...
Well, the Alcott relatives have read the books and love them. I think it's her great nephews have read the books. They are the estate, and they really like them. And they've actually kind of given me nice little endorsements for the covers and everything. The Fox sisters, I don't know if they even have relatives at this point.
Really?
But certainly no one's contacted me about them. And I know for a fact that there is nothing libelous, and there is no way to lie. You know, they're the subject of legend and history at this point. So they're
the reason why the relatives haven't contacted you is because you're afraid of the Ouija board.
Maybe.
Now you have an essay in a book called Alchemy of the Word.
Yes.
Writers talk about writing, and yours is called Originality and Creativity. Tell us a little bit about that essay.
When I teach at Goddard, for our residencies, we always have a keynote presentation where three or four faculty get together and address a common topic. And I was on a keynote a few years ago about originality. And I wanted to do it because in historical fiction, I mean, if you're working with real characters and real events, et cetera, what is the originality in it is the way some people think. And
well,
of
that's
course,
a good question.
It's the interpretation and the choice of emphasis. And there's so much that you do have to invent. But I wanted to write about The Great Gatsby, which is one of my primary texts, and how the story of Jay Gatsby goes all the way back to ancient Rome and all the way forward to S. Hunter Thompson, who used the format of that book in his book, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a story that is told over and over and over again and gets richer for every generation because every generation has to tell it new. And that, to me, was the originality part of the equation, is that, yes, you have the story that is told. Even before the Bible, there were Jay Gatsby's in the world. Mm-hmm. But there still are today. So how can the story be dated? How can it be old? You just have to tell it in a way that suits the readers of today.
Yeah.
And I also talked about John Gardner's novel, Grendel, because the second text I love is the story of Beowulf, the monster, and the hero. And Beowulf, of course, is the hero who kills just about everybody in sight. And Grendel is the monster. And if you haven't read John Gardner's version of it, it is just breathtakingly beautiful and haunting and heartbreaking because so much of his own history is written into it. He had some very awful events in his childhood that he then inserted into Grendel himself. But the story of Grendel, monster versus hero, is again a story that's told over and over.
Oh, it is.
So where is the originality? Well, the originality is the next person who tells it has to take it a step further, change something so that it continues to speak to us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you tell, you know, if the work is good, if it still speaks, if it's grown silent, then it's dead and you can't use it anymore.
Hmm. And some people don't know when it has gone silent.
Yeah, I think so.
Now, you co-edited a book with Diane Ackerman called The Book of Love.
Yes.
What was that about?
Well, Norton asked Diane if she would do an anthology for their series, and Diane asked if I would work with her as an editor on it because she knew my research skills, and we're also friends. And I said, sure, sounds like fun.
And what was the book about?
It's writings about love. From ancient history to contemporary times, all genres. We got a little too ambitious with it. Little too ambitious. But it's got love letters, poems, journal entries, fiction. It's a huge book. And we decided to put in every kind of love we could. So there's even an Anatole France story about a little boy in love with a doll. So we went all out with it.
Did you discover any new things about love that you were surprised?
About love? No. About literature, yes.
Really?
I found an ancient South American Indian piece, Mayan, that is just chilling. A father talking to his daughter, describing the difficulties of the world and how love, and he meant love as physical pleasure, helped make up for some of the difficulties. And whenever I had to read from the Book of Love, I always read that piece. It just... So maybe that one did teach me something, you know.
Always want to learn something.
Yeah,
I would assume somebody
who's
into historical fiction wants to learn new facts.
Yeah.
Now, tell us how you approach teaching creative writing. I always think that that's such a difficult task.
The question leaves me breathless. It works well in the Goddard program because what happens is I work one-on-one with students. So there's no formula of this week we're doing haiku and next week we're going to do the sonnet and then we're going to do autobiographical fiction. The students come in with a project in mind, and I tend to work with the fiction students and nonfiction students. And for 2 years... for 1 year, because they can't stay with me for 2 years, for 1 year I work with them one-to-one on their project.
Mm.
And that part is easy because, well, it's not easy, it's a ton of work, but because it's their work, I just remind myself to step back and tell myself it is their work, and my job is to tell them how to get to the next step of their work, not to tell them what the next step is, but show them how to get there.
Well, so how do you inspire?
Praising when they need praise, encouraging, helping them to fight back the demons that all writers have.
Yeah.
You know, the mother, the husband, the sibling who says, you can't do this, or even just the voice in your own head. Just, you know, helping them recognize that that's a voice to be ignored, to fight it, and just to get up in the morning and do the work. And if they're not doing the work, I just get tough. I mean, it's an academic program.
Are you somebody who believes that somebody really should get up and write every day if you want to be a writer?
Yeah, I really do. It's a skill. It's like tennis or piano or another sport. If you don't do it, you will lose it, really. That's why I get nervous when I talk. When people talk to me about writer's block, I get really nervous because I try not to believe that there is such a thing.
Really?
Yeah. Because I think if you sit at your desk and even just stare at the typewriter or the blank screen for a while, eventually you come up with a sentence and you will have written.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you need to do. And maybe next day it'll be a paragraph.
But so it has to do with discipline more than really a block. People can take a vacation, perhaps.
Absolutely.
An excuse.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so how do you approach your own career? Are you writing every day? Are you thinking about new ideas? How do you keep in practice?
I haven't been writing every day because I had some family complications. Mm-hmm. As our relatives get older, we take on more responsibilities. And I don't like to travel with a computer, so I would just take blocks of time off to kind of do other things, but then come back to my computer. But my guide for me is when I'm home, when I'm not really required to be taking care of other things, I will write on a daily basis. And for me, a daily basis doesn't mean like 7 in the morning to 3 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
I mean, for me,
yeah,
1 or 2 hours, and I'm done for the day. Because it takes a certain part of my brain, and that brain tires really easily.
Yeah, it is a different world that writers have to step into.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you react to reviews, good and bad? Does that affect you as a writer?
Yeah, I'm a little too thin-skinned. But, you know, in general, my reviews have been pretty positive. And if they aren't positive, it's, you know, you can just step back and say, well, what the hell do they know? You know, the stock response.
And the ones who praise you, you say, yes, they know everything.
Exactly. They have taste. They have intelligence. So you just have to keep a perspective. And what I keep coming back to is that it really is about the work, not the results. Because if you wait for the results, especially in this economy with publishers buying less and mm-hmm. Less print space for book reviews, I mean, you can't count on those things. So it has to be about the work itself.
Yeah, I've heard other writers say that it keeps them from being lonely, knowing that they have this work that they have sitting waiting for them. And that's very important in this culture now, I think.
It's very important. And for me, it's even more than dealing with the loneliness that I think most writers do feel, mm-hmm. which is one reason we write. But when I'm not writing for a large period of time, I actually start to feel almost disabled. It's like losing a sense for me, like losing my sense of smell or not seeing as well as I usually do. It becomes really physical.
Well, we're almost out of time, Jean. Is there anything you're working on you can tell us about that might be coming up?
I'm a little superstitious, so I don't talk about books before they've reached a second or third draft, at least all the way through. But I am working in Elizabethan England.
You are?
Yes,
so you're
I am.
Still in the past.
You know, I had a friend years ago who I still have the same friend, but he always teased me about writing historical. And when I told him I was writing Maggie Fox and that had a contemporary timeline in the 20th century, he said, "Why? Did someone tell you the 20th century is almost over?"
Well, I'm delighted that you go into the past, and I do hope some of my listeners go get some of Jean Mackin's books, especially The Sweet By and By. It was fascinating and has a lot about upstate New York history as well. Jean Mackin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.